Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
My next guest has seen it all. From his days growing up in Manchester around the Buzzcocks, Johnny Marr and Factory Records, to presenting the era-defining late-night music magazine show The Word, which featured iconic performances from everyone from Nirvana to Oasis. And now he's at the Edinburgh Festival with a show that grapples with his very Irish Catholic past. Terry Christian, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, actually, I did this show last year, but it was called Naked Confessions of a Recovering Catholic. And it was the Irish stuff that went down the best. And then I realised that I'm never going to recover. So I might as well go with the flow. You know, the superstition is ingrained in me.
Well, it is obviously very, very deep and rich soil for you to furrow confessions of an Irish Catholic. And I guess this show is all about you growing up in Manchester, a very, very Irish town, with both of your Dublin-born parents and your family. When you look back, was the Irish influence very, very strong when you were young?
Well, I mean, it kind of was and it wasn't. I mean, my mum was the seventh of eight kids, and she'd actually moved over to Manchester with all her family when she was only four. So she spoke with an English accent. Her father had actually been, his job was a full-time soldier in the Connaught Rangers. So he was actually in the British Army. That was his job. And he was really badly gassed in World War One and taken prisoner in March 1918 and never worked again. And then her mother, Bridget Heaney, then Cullen, she actually witnessed the surrender of the Easter Rebels on Moore Street, because that's where they were living in the tenements there.
During the Rising, wow.
Yeah, so she witnessed that, and the irony was, my dad's uncle William Christian actually took part in the Rising and was so traumatized by what happened to him that he never took part in the War of Independence. This is a bit like, who do you think you are, isn't it?
Well, when you dig back into the past and then realise there's all sorts of origins and alliances, history can get very complicated, family history very complicated.
Because most of the people in Manchester were Irish, I'd say at least 40% of my mates were all from Mayo, because they were like the last big influx of Irish. And so being a Dubliner, you know, there weren't that many of us. It were Dubliners. And then my mum was very, how can I put it? She was an Anglophile, really. And even her mother, so all my mum's brothers and sisters, none of them married anyone who was Irish. And her mum went mad at it, said to my mum, never marry an Irishman. And she married my dad from the Liberties.
And to add further complication to your personal family history, your parents come from a very mixed Dublin marriage, because your mum's family from Talbot Street and your dad from the Liberties. So a big question for you, Terry Christian, do you identify as a North Sider or a South Sider?
Well, because I've got a first cousin the exact same age as me, John Christian, and he grew up just near Temple Bar. So he was literally from there, and his dad, my uncle Tommy, and he was an only child, so it was great, you know, because I was a fourth or sixth. So if ever you went to Dublin, I would get bought everything he, and he was spoiled rotten. So if he asked for an ice pop or whatever, I knew I was going to get one. You know what I mean? So it was great. But his nearest school was the other side of the Liffey, and his dad wouldn't let him go there. The better school and the nearer one was the other side of the Liffey, and his dad made him go to a school the other side of Maryland instead, because he didn't want his son going to school in North Dublin. And he's a Shamrock Rovers season ticket holder, so I suppose it was always more that Liberty side. My mum's family, you know, all the Cullens, they all moved lock, stock and barrel over to Manchester in 1930.
Did that make... you know, looking at that migration and you know, looking at your family history, did that make their sense of Irishness in any way, you know, complicated? You know, did they talk about the Ireland they knew in a wistful sense, or were they engaging with that, you know, new experience? So did they embrace, or did they tend to minimise their Irish heritage, do you think?
Well, my dad, you know, he used to say, you know, I'm going to go back and leave the lot of yous. Yeah, and because he was the only one from his family who came over. My mum wasn't as enamoured of it. But then she said she thought they were poor. And then when they went to visit, you know, when she was first going out with my dad, and she went over to Dublin with him, you know, when they're engaged to be married. And she said the kids had no shoes on the feet. You know, it was a tenement on number two Augustine Street is where my dad grew up. And I think they were like five floors up because his dad had died at age seven. So they were like the poorest of the poor. And I think the cheaper rents were higher up. And you had to fill a bucket with water from a pump in the yard. You know, and she said she'd never seen anything like it, you know, in terms of poverty.
And do you think, Terry, that your parents, you know, were they staunch or strong, you know, Catholics, or were they sort of a la carte kind of, I guess we call cultural Catholics today? Did they bring that with them?
Well, it's a mixture of both. I mean, you've got to remember that for me, dad, he was actually, because he had TB as a kid, he ended up with a TB abscess on his spine. And so this is only within a few months of getting married to my mum. And he ended up in a sanatorium, back in a sanatorium in Dublin for 18 months, unable to walk, paralysed from the waist down. And somebody gave him a scapula of St. Martin. There you go, St. Martin of Perez. There's a kind of Swiss Army knife of saints. And he actually ended up having an operation. It was a 10,000-to-1 chance. And he always thought, you know, it's that causality stuff. He thought that is what cured him. So he became quite staunch. And my mum went along with him. But then I think my sister died when she was only 11, you know, my oldest sister. And that made my mum never want to go to church again. But my dad again G'd her up and got her back into it. But for the rest of us, it was just something. It was just a balm for your misery, really. You know, going to Mass, going to confession as well. So we'll talk about that. Making your first confession age 6. Sister Bernadette slapping me in the mouth and telling me, if you whistle in church, it makes the Virgin Mary's lips bleed.
I thought it made her cry.
That made stealing a Milky Way seem a less of a sin to me, age 6.
Can I ask you, can I bring you back to your sister Janet? She was so young, she was only 10 or 11 when she died.
11, yeah.
What impact did that have in your family? Like, I mean, as you say, your parents had different approaches perhaps to their faith. And obviously your dad leaned into it, your mum perhaps going away with it. Did it make it a challenging household to grow up in?
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of those where you have to shut up and put up. And kind of, I don't always mention it when I do my shows, unless I feel like I need to bring some context in. But it was kind of, you ended up bringing it up yourself, and then the worst thing you could ever do was upset your mum. So you kept all your problems to yourself. Because, you know, my mum had enough to deal with, you know, in that way. I mean, I don't want to go, you know, because this is one of the weird things when, you know, having been in the media for years, when you're working class, it's often all you ever seem interested in a way, is your trauma or what will trigger you, you know what I mean? So you end up doing that, and maybe that's all. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to describe. I mean, when I really felt it, you know, is whenever I see somebody's lost a child, I just know that's their life finished in a way. You never come back from that. You never. It's not so much. I don't think you're never going to get over it, and even to live with it. I don't know. You know, I think it's maybe a kind of a strength that I don't know where you know how people handle it. You know, with the Manchester bomb, you know, a few years back, that was the thing that most affected me about it. You know, when you sort of looked at those kids who died, and you just thought, that's it. It's just, you know, that's the sin of it all.
And speaking of that, because, you know, what you identified earlier, you know, lots of us grew up with that sort of notion of sin and all of those kind of the saints and the sinners and all of the stories that went around it. All of those tales and I suppose that formation, those young minds, did they stick with you? You know, like whether it was the saints, did it develop a morality or a fear in you?
I mean, it's a strange one, isn't it? You know, because you kind of, half of you thinks, it'd be great to be a saint, you know, go straight to heaven and all that. And then you're going, I'm not sure about how, you know, how most of them met their sticky ends. And, you know, I'm from that era of going to like primary school, you know, and secondary school in the 60s and 70s. We used to call it, I mean, I'm describing one of the books that I wrote where I talk about the Irish upbringing, where we describe nuns as extinction reminders because you were forever talking about the day you were going to die and you're thinking, okay, that's a bit close to home. And then we get a saint story quite often, you know, at primary school. And I kind of equate them in the show to like Aesop's fables, you know, where you tortoise and the hare, you think, yeah, I kind of get that. You know, the race is not to the swift, but to he who endures. You know, the boy who cries wolf, that makes sense. But then when you're getting told some of these saint stories, it's hard to find the win, isn't it?
Some of them can be quite grim.
Yeah, St. Lucy having her eyes plucked out by her dad because she refuses to marry a bloke who's not a Christian.
It's a bit extreme. Her win
was like God allowed her to see out of the empty sockets
of her eyes, and the miracle. Yeah. The miracle endured. Can you talk to me about your school experience? Obviously, it was Manchester, strong Irish influence, but presumably a mixed upbringing. Was it a Catholic school or was it?
I mean, don't forget, Manchester's like, it's quite a high proportion of Catholics. I think it's like 35% or something mad like that, even 40%. So at primary school, I went to St. Alphonsus in Old Trafford. So in my class was John Marr out of Buzzcocks. And then three of us passed our 11 plus from there to go to the top Catholic grammar school in Manchester that was near us, St. Bede's College. So I went there. And then in my class at St. Bede's was Chris Nagle, who was the main engineer on the Joy Division album, Unknown Pleasures, and then produced loads of other Manchester bands, you know, worked with New Order, produced all the other Manchester bands like Yago and people like that over the years, worked with Simply Red. And then the year below us was Andy Connell out of A Certain Ratio and Swing Out Sister.
Yeah, it seems like the divine was well at work in Manchester.
There was just a lot. But I mean, you know, those Catholic schools, it gave you such an edge going to Catholic schools in terms of education. I mean, my Catholic school was like Borstal with incense. Do you know what I mean? It was a tough place. It did give you an edge over other people.
And when you look at that back, I often kind of think that maybe Irish Catholic guilt or however it's perceived is arguably one of our greatest and most successful exports. Did you take it on board as a young person? Was it something that was in the back of your mind, or did you have the fear of God?
I grew up in a rough area, didn't I? As I say in my show, you know, we had the one thing money couldn't buy, poverty. And you kind of have those murky boundaries. So again, this is in the show where I talk about the deed being the thought being the same as the deed. So you just thought, well, I might as well get hung for a sheep as a lamb. So in many ways, we were kind of worse than the other kids because the guilt's always going to be there, whether because if the sin is just thinking about doing it, then you might as well do it.
Yeah. The guilt is there whether you do it or not. Can I ask, are you,
yes.
You know, not because obviously you are spending time reflecting on the influence of faith and growing up. Are you in any way spiritual now? Like, I mean, would you consider yourself a Catholic or Catholic adjacent?
Well, I mean, the thing is, because I've still got certain superstitions, and I look for patterns where there aren't any. I mean, one of the freeing things, and I've done therapy, is to just see life as aimless and pointless, you know, and that's quite freeing. Why does everything have to have a meaning behind it, you know? And that's part of the amusement of the saints, because it is, you know, even like the superstitions about fairies. So when I do my show, I've got the final warm-up tonight, and it'll be quite a lot of, you know, where people of Irish descent there, and I'll ask them, how many of you in here, if I offered you 500 quid to chop down a fairy tree, would do it?
I wouldn't.
Well, exactly. And the weird thing is like, you know, you'll get some of the Protestants will put their hands up, but none of the Irish Catholics will. And they might not even go to church, and they might be proper atheists, which I am, but I still wouldn't do it. And the worst thing is like, the Protestants would do it, take the money, forget about it. You'd do it, and then in 16 years' time, something would go wrong in your life, and you think, that's because I did that. And that's because of chopping down the fairy tree. If only I'd left it alone.
And the guilt would come back. Can I bring you back? Just even chatting to you brings me back to my teenage years. But your entry into the world of broadcasting is so intriguing. And in many respects, given the area you came from, the social class you came from, unexpected. How did you end up on TV with a very, very young Johnny Marr on Devil's Advocate?
Well, I mean, the strange thing was I'd just completed an HND at Manchester Polytechnic, and this is in 1981, and it's Thatcher, and there just weren't any jobs around. So I was kind of misbehaving and staying out late, drinking, because we know, you know, and then staying in bed till 2 p.m. And my mum worked on the school dinners at my old primary school, and there's a woman that she worked with called Josie Flanagan. I think she was Tipperary. There you go. So basically, she had her oldest son, Kevin, ran a group in St. Anthony's in Trafford Park called the Young Christian Workers. And he'd been asked to supply unemployed kids in the inner city, you know, to be kind of auditioned to see if they'd be suitable for this show made by the World in Action team based on the Scarman report after the riots of 1981. And because my mum was always moaning about me still being in bed at 2 o'clock when she got home, I kind of got put forward for that.
How unemployment was affecting you
I was the victim, you know what I mean? As if I was the victim. But it was there. So I was on that for 7 weeks, and Johnny Marr, age 17, was on it. But the weird thing is, so I then ended up getting a job on the radio for BBC Radio Derby. And when that first Smiths track, Hand in Glove, came out in May of 1983, I instinctively knew it was him. Because we talk about music quite a lot, you know, in local bands. And it was the sort of start, you know, it's that new romantic thing. But then there was still the sort of two-tone thing around. But there was a frustration with the new romantic thing because there's something not very exciting about seeing guys just stood there behind keyboards.
So what was the secret sauce? How come Manchester in particular and the working class suddenly became so cool? It broke through as a cultural zeitgeist. Was it just the talent, or was it tapping into that, you know, what you're talking about there, that frustration and anger at the politics of that time?
Well, I think there was that. I think it's one of the great immigrant cities. Eamon Dunphy, you know, the kind of sport, but he's a good writer. So in his book, A Strange Kind of Glory, when he wrote about, you know, Sir Matt Busby, because he was kind of a youth player, wasn't he, at Manchester United as a fullback, he actually describes Manchester as being the most un-English of English cities. And when you grow up in the city centre of Manchester like I did, you know, our street, you're either Irish descent or Jamaican. So even the first black British band to get to number one in the UK charts were a band called Sweet Sensation.
Yeah, of course.
Sad Sweet Dreamer. So that was September 74. So Marcel King went to the local Catholic secondary modern, St George's, because he was mixed race, but he was half Irish. So it always had that. So the influences came from everywhere. There wasn't that weird, you get a certain pub rock vibe out of other places that always makes it sound a little bit old-fashioned, whereas in Manchester, there's always that kind of groove to the music. There's a certain energy level as well there, you know. So even like, you know, Noel out of Oasis, you know, I knew for a long time, but I remember like one of his favourite records when we'd be down the Hacienda. He used to love Strings of Life by Rhythm is Rhythm and all that stuff. And, you know, we all like that music too. And people used to talk stuff about, you know, like a indie dance crossover. But in the days when you had to pay to get into a nightclub, you would have to, you'd want to go somewhere where they were playing decent music. You wouldn't want to go somewhere where the music was really naff. So often, you know, you'd want to go to the clubs that were playing, you know, good funk, good dance music, all the rest of it.
You broke through really with The Word, this music magazine show that started off in an early slot, ended up, I think, at one point nearly taking 50% of the audience share for a late night programme. You were, you know, as inner city Manchester as you can get. Was that a shock for you to suddenly embrace that fame and to be at the front of, you know, what for many of us was a sort of big cultural musical revolution?
Well, the frustration for me was radio is what I loved. And I'd won 2 National Sony Radio Awards, Best Specialist Music Show, 2 years running, youngest person to win one, first person to win 2. And nowadays, you would go straight into Radio 1 with that. Well, because of my accent, there was no chance of that in those days. So I did do a kind of youth programme on Radio 4 for a while called Wavelength Plus. And that's where I met Jo Wiley. She was a researcher on it. So later on, I got her on for Series 2 and half of Series 3 as the music booker on The Word. But I mean, really, it was a side issue to me. I didn't really like the show. I didn't, you know, the format was based loosely on my radio show, the one that I did with a guy called John Ronson, who became like a big writer.
A little
and
bit
he was
famous.
My sidekick. well, the weird thing is, he was down on his luck because he'd just been sacked as a manager of a band called The Man from Del Monte, who were described in Manchester as Smiths fans' third favourite band. And they, you know, they were good. I mean, they get like 1,000 people at a gig, The Man from Del Monte, but he'd been sacked from there. But I always thought, well, he's quite amusing and he's a character. And obviously he sounds so different to me that you get that aural texture. That was a big one for me on the radio, aural texture. You know, so you could tell who was speaking and when. You know, where sometimes with the smashy and nicey type DJs, you think, well, who's speaking now? They both sound the same. So, yeah, John Ronson, you know, and it was like, and then also the name of the show came from the page I wrote in the Manchester Evening News called The Word Page, which appeared every Friday, and that covered up and coming bands from Manchester. So that's where bands like the Charlatans got their very first write-up on. Oasis did, but it was a week when I was away, and Penny Anderson did it.
Were you conscious, before we get on to The Word, because it was such a juggernaut and a phenomenon and potentially, from what you're saying, a double-edged sword, but were you conscious of class as your brand and your audience share increased? Were you conscious about it? You know, you got a lot of perhaps unfavourable coverage.
Well, yes, but it's like I was conscious of that even when I worked for the BBC in Derby. You know, because you would see people kind of coming, you know, from Oxbridge, and they'd be fast-tracked on for the Today programme on Radio 4. Even when I won my second Sony Award in 1986, and I'm waiting for the call from Radio 1, they took on Simon Mayo, you know, from BBC Radio Nottingham, 20 miles down the road. And the only reason I could think of at the time, rightly or wrongly, was public schoolboy. Even though I went to a school which has now gone private. So maybe if it had gone back in time. But yeah, I mean, it was a very strange one. It was kind of, it was a bit like being in Downton Abbey. You know, I remember going there and I had like 8 years of experience of, you know, I managed bands. I actually got a reggae band signed to Chrysalis Records in the mid 80s and managed them for like 3 years. You know, I promoted gigs at, you know, at night at clubs and all sorts of stuff. And so when I went in to do The Word, I already had this kind of background of writing about new stuff, listening to demo tapes, and suddenly I'd be in a meeting and I felt like the gardener on Downton Abbey. You know, where I'd be like, I think we should book this new band, the Manic Street Preachers. Well, that's, I've never heard of them. You know, I felt like, well, I think we should plant the roses in April this year, Squire. How dare you speak out of turn? And it was so odd. It was a bit like a YTS scheme for posh kids. And they haven't done much, you know, most of them have done like maybe 6 months on one of those, you know, reportage type programmes.
Do you think that TV broadcasting, the world of media generally, is still a closed shop for working class people and voices?
I mean where it counted against me was I just got terrible press, you know, permanently. And it wasn't even true, you know, because you'd be going, well, if it was so awful, why are we getting a 49% audience share on a Friday night? Why are they giving me more money every year? Why aren't they sacking me? But it was like you were portrayed as being famously inarticulate, a moron, all these awful things, you know, and it was kind of all done out of jealousy. But when you've grown up with nothing, there was never anything that anyone was ever jealous of me about, except for maybe when I passed me 11 plus. I don't think my mum was ever prouder of me than that day. But do you know what I mean? So you never had anything for anyone to be jealous about. And so you struggle with anybody disliking you because of that, because you think, well, other maybe a prettier girl, you know, that I went out with when I was 18. What was there for you to be jealous of
me
about?
Terry, did that impact you, or did it make you more, sounds really cliched, but it, did it make you more sort of determined to get ahead, or did any of that kind of seep into you?
I think it kind of deflated me. I mean, I fought against it for as long, but it was relentless. And so it was like you were being bullied all the time. And then what I found particularly frustrating was, even after the word, I would put together program ideas, documentary ideas, because that's what I was interested in. You know, I'm a proper geek, and I wouldn't even get the meeting.
You know, when I look back at the word and, you know, the competition to get on to that, to be, you know, to be presented to the world and how it changed television. Look, I mean, you did have a big influence in terms of who could get on it. Like, I mean, you pushed, like, I mean, this weekend, you know, all of the people going to see Oasis here in Dublin have been travelling elsewhere to see them.
Yeah, but eight weeks of arguing the toss to get them on.
Yeah, you had to push to get them on the show.
They haven't. I mean, what had happened is, now, you know, it's the old saying, success has many fathers, but failure is an orphan. And they didn't even sound like the sort of stuff that anyone was going to take seriously in 1994, because they were kind of like a poppier version of the Stone Roses, with those obvious kind of, you know, 60s influences and everything. And but I really liked it. And I remember getting the, because I knew Noel, I hadn't rated the first demo tape that much, and I've been to see them live a couple of times. But again, you know, the boardwalk where they used to play was awful. I don't think any band could sound good there. It's one of those places that's become legendary as if it was really good, but it was absolutely awful. And when I got the live demonstration tape, as it was then called, which they did with the real people in Liverpool, I just thought, this is great, because you could hear these songs. And, you know, and Liam's voice sounded good, and I knew that Liam was a good-looking lad. And Noel's girlfriend, who he lived with in India House in Manchester, Louise Jones, he was with her for about 6 years. She was the PA for the plugging company that, well, the mother of my kids ran with a partner. She's a McDermott, actually, from Ballyhadreen out that way, you know, her family, Susan McDermott. And she'd broken the Stone Roses. She was fantastic at her job. So she did the first two Oasis albums.
What do you think made Oasis so special at the time? Like, I mean, there were some great bands around there.
There was really nothing else around at the time. So you had all the American stuff, you know, like the grunge bands, but that was like old rock. That was like something in the mid-70s, you know, really. I mean, you know, you had odd great tracks there, but if you listen even to the Lemonheads, you know, like if you looked at someone like Evan Dando or even Kurt Cobain, if you were a 15-year-old kid living in an inner city council house, you might like the tune, but you wouldn't go, I want to be him. You wouldn't look at Kurt Cobain and want to be him. You wouldn't look at Evan Dando and want to be him. But you would look at Liam Gallagher and want to be him. You'd look at Ian Brown out of the Stone Roses and want to be him. So there was that appeal that they had.
Heaven forbid, Terry Christian, that lad culture might return. But is there a risk with Oasis reforming? And are we looking at a sort of second coming of the 90s? Or is that kind of...
I mean, you've got to remember, a lot of the lads culture of Oasis is more that kind of appeal. And Manchester bands always seem to appeal to the sort of football hooligan types. I mean, Joy Division did. New Order did. You wouldn't have been stuck on a bus with a load of Joy Division fans back in the day. Likewise, even the Smiths, you know, the football hooligans. It's just the kind of dynamic, you know, it's what it is. It's that kind of pop music with an edge. And, you know, and those sort of anthemic type songs, really.
Looking around you now, or looking at the future of music, you know, what kind of bands or what kind of music, what genres are giving the former presenter of The Word hope at this time?
Well, I mean, I'm too old. You see, with me, I never even took any notice of what someone aged 21 would tell me about music. I'd only listen to 16 and 17-year-olds because then it means something to you. So I really like Seb Lowe, who's from sort of Oldham, Saddleworth way. He's quite political but quite funny with it. Like Billy Bragg with a sense of humour. I mean, I like the Fontaines D.C. But again, when I hear the Fontaines D.C., the first time I heard them, I thought, they're The Fall, aren't they, really? A more tuneful version of The Fall from Manchester. So I think they're more interested. I mean, again, you know, a lot of these bands are more interested than Oasis. But in terms of that impact, there's been nothing has come since. And I don't think anything will quite come again. That's like them. And it might be irritating. I remember what Bob Dylan said when he first heard Wonderwall. And he said, right, this band are huge, what do you think? And he said, it sounds like musical grave robbing with British accents. You know, because obviously they're using like the Beatles and the Neil Young type, you know, guitar. So it wasn't wrong, but the whole point is there's nothing else has come up. Even the Arctic Monkeys, they just haven't quite got that. I don't know, you know, there's something less intimidating about Liam than there is about, you know, the guy at the Arctic Monkeys, because Liam, although he's laddish, he's got feet of clay as well. So he's got that relatability.
So the new Oasis hasn't emerged for you yet. Can I ask you, just before I let you go, because I know and for the show in Edinburgh, how does Terry Christian see himself now? Are you British or Irish? Are you still consumed with Catholic guilt?
Well, I mean, my younger brother, Kevin Patrick, there's a curse.
There we go.
So he actually worked as part of the Celtic Tiger in Ireland for a few years. And it used to irritate him, you know, because obviously we're not part of that West of Ireland type. So we'd go to the Irish clubs, you know, because we, you know, the Dubliners had their own pubs that they went to. My dad's best mate, actually, who came over on the same boat from Dublin with him. And worked at Massey Ferguson's and Jesse Broad's with him as a guy called Tommy Cody. And his niece was John Sheridan, the footballer's mum. So, you know, to the day he died, my dad used to meet him every Sunday after Mass in the Platford, the Dubliners pub in Old Trafford. But I suppose it's like, I don't know. Our Kev, you know, he went out with a girl from Donegal, and some bloke there said to him, he said, what do you think of the IRA? And our Kev said, I find all forms of nationalism abhorrent. And I'm a bit like that. But, you know, I'm vaguely proud of being Irish. And obviously we're all getting our passports now because of the idiocy of Brexit. But it's a weird one. So I find being Irish different. It's, you know, we're wired differently, I'd say, to the English. But I would support England at football against Ireland, which my dad never would. But we all would. Maybe if Ireland are a better team, we might switch sides.
Well, you've given us a lot to reflect on. Confessions of an Irish Catholic is at the Edinburgh Festival until August 24th. Would you be brave enough to bring it to Dublin, Terry Christian?
Absolutely. I did the Naked Confessions version of it in Belfast years back. That was an interesting experience, you know, going up there and saying, are there any Catholics in the audience? It's just what I asked. And then you're thinking, the hands went up quite hesitantly. I suppose it's because the last time someone with an accent like mine asked them a question like that, they were in danger of getting the doors kicked in at 3 a.m. in the morning. But
context, as always, is king. Terry Christian, I hope you do bring your show to Ireland.
I'd love to. I mean, I did the Word one at the Sugar Club a couple of times, but I would love to bring this one over to Dublin. I need a proper agent, don't I?
You do indeed, but I think that's what you should get going on. But not before we let you go away to your show at the Edinburgh Festival. Terry Christian, absolute joy to speak to you today. Thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks, Dursley.